I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Chef Charles Fan, whose restaurants include Slanted Door, Hard Water, and Heaven's Dog. He's joined in conversation by Jonathan Kaufman, San Francisco editor of Tasting Table. And now, join Brian Garrick on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Charles Fan and Jonathan Kaufman.
Charles Fan was 12 years old when he left his hometown of Dalat in 1975, right before the fall of Saigon, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City. His family went to Guam for 2 years before settling in the United States. With both his parents working two jobs, he cooked for his family throughout high school, combining his mother's traditional Vietnamese recipes with new American ingredients. Eventually, in 1995, Charles opened his first restaurant, The Slanted Door, on Valencia Street in the Mission. At that time, the Mission was completely different than the restaurant-laden landscape that it is today. The Slanted Door became a destination restaurant with a stylish interior and an ingredient-driven menu, taking advantage of the wonderful locally sourced products of the Bay Area. And in 2004, the restaurant moved into the Ferry Building, where it has become one of the signature restaurants in our city. That same year, Chef Fan was honored with a James Beard Award for Best Chef in California. Since then, Chef Fan has expanded his empire, including two locations of Out the Door, Wo Hing General Store, a Chinese street food restaurant, which is located in the original Slanted Door location, the Academy Cafe and the Moss Room at the California Academy of Sciences, and Heaven's Dog, a modern Chinese restaurant with delicious cocktails. And he's at work on his next project, a restaurant and bar at the new SF Jazz Center. As successful as he's been with his many restaurants, Chef Fan still considers himself, quote, a glorified home cook. And his first book, Vietnamese Home Cooking, is intended for all of us who consider ourselves home cooks. Appearing here in conversation with Chef Fan is the award-winning food writer and San Francisco editor of TastingTable.com, Jonathan Kaufman. So without further ado, please welcome Charles Fan and Jonathan Kaufman to the stage.
Well, hello. Welcome. So I'm going to start this conversation off by asking you a question that I was reminded of, that I've had for 17 years, but was reminded of when I was reading the book. And that's, when you first opened The Slanted Door in 1995, you were, you and your family maxed out all of your credit cards. You didn't have any experience running a restaurant. You were opening a restaurant serving a cuisine that a lot of people weren't familiar with, and you were going to charge slightly more than, rock-bottom prices. And you were opening it up in a neighborhood that didn't have a lot of high-end dining options. So my question is, A, what were you thinking? And B, why was it so successful?
First of all, hi. this is the biggest crowd I ever had, so if I fumble, don't laugh too hard. Thank you for having me here. It's a huge honor. Why? Well, a little background. I mean, I went to Cal. I went to Mission High. We came to San Francisco, and Dad was got a job at an English restaurant in Chinatown, a place called The Coachman. Any of you guys been here in San Francisco? Yeah, steak and kidney pie and prime rib. He was a janitor, so I got a job busing table. And I kind of was starting the restaurant business really young. I was in eighth grade in 1978, and I work, and I went to Cal, and I continue to work. I always thought there was a niche in the marketplace that someone should do this Vietnamese food. At the time, in 80s and 90s, Chinatown was mostly Chinatown. There weren't a lot of, even Tenderloin, there weren't a lot of Vietnamese yet. So there weren't a lot of Vietnamese restaurants. I mean, even though our parents are Chinese, we didn't see a lot of Vietnamese food. And I just saw this whole sort of niche in the marketplace. But to answer your question why, our parents are immigrant and refugees, and my mom started a sewing shop, and she don't know how to sew. And she got a job. She came here. I don't know how long she got. There's a guy, a company called Ben Davids. They were big union shop, and I remember she went to work. She applied, and they asked if she know how to sew. Of course, she lies. She say yes, she know how to sew. And Ben Davids was a production, so piecework. So you only learn how to do one thing. They were doing pants, so you don't sew the whole pants. You just sew maybe the zipper or the waistband, and she had to do zipper. And my dad actually was very similar back in Vietnam. He had a beef jerky business. I think we were just entrepreneur, and I saw a niche in the marketplace. You know, we got in the sewing shop business, and we didn't. I did that for a little bit. I didn't like it, and finally it was my turn to start my own business. And I had went out and got a job in between selling software, between the Slamdoor job and before, after college. I was in the garment and software, and it didn't bother me that I didn't know how to cook. But the reason is I saw Chez Panisse and Zuni had 6-7 items, because I couldn't be like a Chinese restaurant with 100 items. I surely can't cook 100 items. So I just have confidence that if I figure cook 6 or 7 things, mm-hmm. I can open the restaurant. But crazy enough, I thought I can build it with $20,000. So naive, but it's. Sometimes helps if you don't know how bad it's going to be. You know.
Did you design it to yourself? Because I know you went to UC Berkeley for architecture school.
Yeah, it was actually 8 months. You know, I had a software job, and this is prior to actually Google or I think Explorer was just coming out at the time, and Netscape, and that was when I was in the software, and our company got venture fund and went belly up because they spend it all, and I was going to continue to do software or take that money to start Slamdoor, and I was on the verge of moving to Hong Kong and continue to sell software for the SGI, but I decided to start Slamdoor, and 8 months I went around looking at wanted ad. I mean, back then there was wanted ad, and you look at buy businesses, and we found places in the Tenderloin, and it was just, you know, after 8 months of trying and finally found the space on Valencia Street. It was really cheap, and I figure I have enough money to last for a year worth of rent, and mm-hmm. I was paying $2,000 a month, and I was living with my mom, so I didn't have to pay rent at home, so I'm good.
So was your family involved in the restaurant as well when you opened up?
No, it was just, you know, everybody had jobs, so somebody's got to pay the bills, right? Just me and my brother and my aunt, three of us, and my wife. When I opened it a year later, it took me a year to build it. So 94 and 95, and I got married the year I opened, the first month I opened. Mm-hmm. That's another story.
So, how did you pick the dishes that you wanted to serve at the original Slamdoor?
Well, all these are classic dishes that every Vietnamese, like you go down, like today, the spring roll, the catfish clay pot, the lemongrass chicken. There are a lot of dishes. I wasn't worried about. So my food is not really about. Like sometimes I concoct it. My thing is really bring a piece of Vietnam to here. So, and it, obviously, growing up, there's plenty of dishes I can use from, you know. But there are a lot of street food, and it was a problem in the beginning because, like, you get a big bowl of noodle soup. In Vietnam, there's so many things I like. You can out in the street, little stall, you get a little street food, or you sit down, have like a full meal, restaurant meal with appetizer and entree, like banquet meal. So, like, all these things I want, but how do you put that in a restaurant context? It gets very confusing. And people don't know what they are. They just want it. It's like somebody want a ham and egg and English muffin at 10 o'clock at night. I mean, that's equivalent. That's what's going on, right? And people come into my restaurant at night and say, we want beef noodle soup and pho, and that's what they know. But that's like asking for a Grand Slam breakfast at 10 o'clock at night. And it was just like, what are you doing? You know, so it was just a lot of educating. I think we made a conscious decision not to serve that at night and just serve the dishes that work in these environments. And we're very disciplined and not have anything bigger than the menu that we have, which is like 8.5 by 11. And later on, move it 8.5 by 14. And then we start changing the fonts, you know. and the whole thing is not to have too much stuff and get things fresh. And it was exciting. And I do know the restaurant business. I do want the modern accoutrement, the wine, the European dessert, and the service. I come from the service side. So that's why we call it Slam Door. We want a name that you weren't thinking about what you're going to get, so you don't expect, you know, free. You know, it's funny, like, people expect free tea to go to a Chinese restaurant. So so I didn't want to give myself a Chinese name, so, and I charge a lot of money for tea, you know, so. And we were breaking a lot of ground. I mean, we were charging more money for tea than the Ritz-Carlton because we were buying $180 pound oolong from China. I mean, this stuff just costs more than a lot of things. it was new. China was opening up. China, for years, you didn't get the fancy tea. And I remember, this was 94, probably early 90, Roy Fong from Imperial, he was bringing tea. He was in Chinatown. I got to meet him. David Hoffman, I just met him. And all this good stuff was coming out of China then because things were opening up. And all of a sudden you start, oh my God, these things are like, you can brew it 3 times. It was so expensive. And crazy enough, today's tea, you actually get worse quality today because the people in China got a lot more wealthy, the big... Big, you know, governor and, you know, mayor and so on. So all the good stuff is going to Beijing. We don't get as good as compared to what we used to get for the amount of pricing. A lot more competition today. But we were like, I don't care. It's just really good. And obviously, I can't give it out at $180 a pound. So I had to charge people, and I get a lot of people get upset. And it's like, you know, we get free teas for, you know, a Chinese restaurant all the time. Why can't you give free tea? Don't you have any free tea? And I say, no. And they're like, I don't want any tea anymore, you know. So
Did you spend a lot of time in those early days managing expectations of what you should be or what you should be serving or what you should be charging?
Yeah. But like anything out of the business, you know, whatever the street price is, you sell them, right? You can't overcharge. I mean, back then, spring roll appetizers were like $4 to $5. And it's a real challenge because I think we're used to certain things priced certain way. And if you buy chicken really cheap and the system is designed to make it very cheap, then it's really hard to go beyond that. All of a sudden, even a farmer try to make a better chicken. I will give you an example. A commodity chicken in wholesale is about $1.50, $2 a pound. And if you buy any decent organic chicken, it's about $4 a pound. But some of these chicken, because they were designed to grow so fast, the breed's called Cornish cross, and they use them, and it's all production in this country to grow fast so that they can harvest it in 6 weeks. And even the organic and natural, it just doesn't have the taste that I look for, that I learn, and I grew up with. And even the Chinese market in Chinatown, you'll see chicken that are like $10-$12 for a 2-pound bird, which is equate to $5 a pound. So, and we got to change that expectation. We got to change it to say, all right, maybe you couldn't have, you know, chicken, fried chicken pieces every day, but rather you might pay a little bit more. I mean, some of these chicken, and I think there's a resurgency in smaller farm, try to bring different breed. Like we get this one farm out of Dinnabell at Slandor, we pay $22 for a bloody chicken, one chicken wholesale. And it's really good, but it's really hard to figure out how to get that pricing, get that and sell it because, but at the same time, you got to draw the line somewhere because it takes them, this chicken takes them twice the amount of month to grow them. And if you're doing organic, you got to move the pasture. You can't, you know, you don't put them in cages, on and on. So,
has that always been a focus? I mean, since the very beginning, I know that it's still, you know, it's a big part of your reputation and a big part of, it sounds like, the mission of what you do. But you know, did that from the get go? Was that something you were looking at?
No, in the beginning, I was just looking for good food. I wasn't really into, you know, trying to save the world or anything. But I was just looking for good food. And the more I look, the more I realize, like, this is not, you know, commodity market isn't a good place for me to look for good food. So we start buying organic thing a year into it. And now it's just really, the rest is just sourcing, whether or not you're organic or not. If you're clean, you're small farm. You know, it took us a long time to figure out how to stop buying frozen shrimp from Asia. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't have a choice. It took us, you know, probably 14 years to get away from that because there just weren't a solution out here. And now we have it. You know, we got a guy that put shrimp on Southwest Airlines standby, you know, comes out here. And I'm not making this up. It's true. And he puts in a big ice bin. If he gets on Southwest Airlines, and we can get it at $14 a pound. Again, you know, frozen is about $7 a pound of, you know, shrimp that are from China, from Thailand, frozen, that are farm raised. So there's just a lot of questions to ask, and you can't really move, you know, all of a sudden your pricing go crazy in a neighborhood restaurant. And we try our best, you know.
What about specialty ingredients like Asian vegetables and herbs? Was that hard to build a supply network for that stuff?
Well, that changed over the year, and I remember there's a mint that we use in the book called Rao Rum. It's a Vietnamese mint. And I don't remember seeing here. I've been here since 1977, and I think in the early 80s, somehow it shows up. And I'm sure somebody smuggled it across the country somewhere and brought it here and started growing it. And I remember people in the Tenderloin and family would pass these little twigs and wet napkin, and you put it in your yard, and next thing you know, it'd take over the yards like some wild wheat. Yes, Chinatown is very different, you know, 20 years ago. The unfortunately, it's dying at the same time, Chinatown, because the pattern of migration, the people that move here, they don't just go to Chinatown anymore. You know, people come and they move to Burlingame and, you know, Hillsboro with, you know, pretty fancy cars. And it wasn't like the Chinatown that I know of. So the migration is different, but the demand's higher, so now you have these big Ranch 99 store, whereas back then Chinatown. But there's definitely a group of farmers that's always been there. And by the way, they're not Chinese. You know, a lot of farmers that are for years, 40, 50 years, have been working with the Chinese market that grow product specifically for the Chinese market. And I think most of you guys probably don't know, there's actually a big... There's a chicken slaughterhouse in Chinatown, and for years Chinatown was confined to, you know, Sacramento and Broadway and Stockton and Grant, and nobody gets out of that little circle. I mean, people didn't have car, they didn't drive and buses, so everything has to happen there, and they needed fresh products, so they have. People, there is a USDA plant, approved USDA plant, slaughterhouse on Grand Street, and no one knows about it.
Is it connected to a retail store?
Yes. They kill the chicken. You'll see the chicken in the back. They have a slaughterhouse in there, and they do in small batches. At one point, there was two or three of them in Chinatown. So But not just processing the food. Chinatown used to have, you know, like if you go there 2 a.m, you'll see all the truck, like, you know, from Petaluma, duck truck, just loads and loads of the product that moved just on the cardboard boxes. You'll see like how much product actually moves through Chinatown. And I think it's come back to this book. It's just, if you teach people how to eat, and once they know how to eat, then they learn how to cook, and they can make food with very, you know, little money. And mm-hmm. Chinatown is not exactly high income per capita, but you look at the amount of food that processed through there, it's amazing. But it's changing. It's dying, and there weren't as many butcher shops. There weren't as many. There's still some, but it's moving to neighborhood. Then you start having the Richmond. I remember in the Sunset Richmond, they weren't any of those Chinese stores back in the 80s and 70s. Now it's just they're spreading out different. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that they're completely gone. It's just not in San Francisco, you know, like mm-hmm. here on Powell Street anymore. So. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to chef and restaurateur Charles Fan, who's joined in conversation by Jonathan Kaufman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So, you know, when you talk about the, you talked about the book, and was that part of your mission in writing the book, was trying to help teach people how to cook?
Yeah, I procrastinated. I waited, and for a long time, publisher would come by and try to have lunch and ask me, and, you know, Bill from Chronicle, and Aaron's from 10 Speed, and I would come out with some excuses why I'm not writing a book, and first I say I was making a baby, so, you know, then that took a year, and then went after three babies, and I ran out of excuses because I didn't make any more baby after that. But I think partly it's because I just, you know, a little nervous about this stuff, you know. You kind of put it on paper, and I needed more, and I didn't really want to do a slam door cookbook just because slam door is more about the story about the company, how it's built. I kind of see it like a high school yearbook of my life or something like that. So I didn't want to do that yet. And so the book, I just realized this is how I teach my staff. You know, this is how I learned from my mom and from all the folks, like, you know, back in Vietnam. Mom was working a lot, so I was hanging around with the folks that worked for my mom and see them cook. And there's a whole sequence why they do certain pattern. But in Vietnam, they don't tell you why, the rationale. They just do it. You know, you do it wrong, they hit you, you know.
So, could have sold the book with a paddle or something.
Yeah, yeah, they do. I'm not going to lie, but they do whack you back then. Somehow you can't do that anymore today. So I just feel like if you understand the principle behind all this, then all this stuff would make sense. And that's why we break the book down to 7 chapters and these cooking technique. Mm-hmm. We call it soup, but it's more like broth making than braising, grill, and stir fry. And we had to throw in the street food chapter just because when you talk about Vietnamese food, there's just like the miscellaneous pile. But each chapter is really trying to explain to you the principle, how these dishes are made. And like if you do a beef and broccoli, why do you do the beef first, not the garlic? Well, if you put the garlic down, you'll burn that thing before you get to the beef, right? You'll never marinate your beef with garlic, because if you're going to brown a piece of meat, you know, you can't put garlic all over it or throw the onion. The onion will sweat, and you got to have a pool of water. So all these are food principles that it could cover any kind of cuisine if you understand them. I'll give you an example. Like in soup making, if the French will bake their bone and roast them to get the nutty flavor, but really when you bake the bone, you actually coagulate and harden all the blood particle so you can have a clear soup. You know, if you don't, then all the scum gets up on top. Well, in Vietnam, we don't have oven, and it's a poor country. It's just not in our repertoire. So we use boiling water to boil the soup when we throw away the first water. So it might seem strange that all of a sudden somebody boils soup like doing laundry and wash it out and wash it again. But it's really, if you kind of put it together, you realize that what they try to do is all that dirty stuff you don't need, you just rinse it out, you boil it in water, but 2 or 3 minutes, you put in cold water, mm-hmm. and you all that stuff, because you actually, the heat will suck all the blood inside the vessel, and it comes out, it, you know, come out of the edges, it hardens, so you can have a clean broth mm-hmm. when you make beef broth.
Were there any other techniques that you were really, you felt really strongly that you wanted to teach people about, or that are central to Vietnamese cuisine that Westerners wouldn't be as familiar with?
Well, you kind of need them all. I don't think you can skip any of them, but I think you just pick the one you like. I love to burn stuff, so I like to have a fire. I like grilling. For me, if I, you know, on a weekend at home, building a fire, and there's something, we talk about, we have a place in Napa, I build a cooking hearth outside, I like to cook with fire. But, you know, if you live in an apartment, that might not be a good idea, you know. I think all the stuff is just really designed so that you could, if you have an apartment, you don't have a good hood, maybe you can cook this outdoor on the deck, and you can move your grill, or you walk outside, because when I give people suggestion building their kitchen, I say you spend the money on the hood first, because I don't like to come into a house when I smell the food before I eat it, and that's why a lot of people don't cook, because their house smells so bad, because they stink it up, because they have bad hood system, because I think a lot of our kitchen design come from too many magazines, and we don't really look at why we build these things, and we put oven on the wall with no hood over it. I mean, it's only good for cooking in my, view. Oven, double-deck oven on the wall just doesn't do anything for me, because if you roast a prime rib or anything, any oil, you can have smoke and the whole house smell like prime rib before, and you smell like prime rib, and you don't want to eat it. So for me, if you start understand that and you can move, you can use like the most expensive stove or the cheap, you could be on a Winnebago and you can make this food. And it's just a matter of batching it, doing it, know when to pull out, when to pick the food that you would cook, and
what would be sort of the main differences between like a Vietnamese home kitchen and sort of San Francisco home kitchen?
Well, I don't know. I left Vietnam a long time ago. All the people in Vietnam, they want to have a kitchen like yours. white Carrera, and go to IKEA and load it up. I like a place I can work. I like to see everything. I don't like everything hide away. I like a kitchen just busy with shelving. But our, every design magazine you see, it's all cupboards, all hide away, and you open, and you start screaming your wife's name. It's like, where's that chicken? Where's that curry powder? Or you bury some stuff in there, it'll sit in there for the next 5 years because you don't know what's inside. So for me, Ole Lundberg's my good buddy, drinking buddy, and architect who designed all my restaurants. We always talk about an ideal kitchen would be, having food and visual to inspire you to cook. A lot of books, shelving. If you buy, I think some of these books, like Chef's Kitchen, one of my favorites, Ken Ham. Ken used to be a chef. He moved to France, Chinese chef out of Chicago. It's just always like busy. It's like a library. Just things just everywhere, and cleaver, and you should have a big jar of all your utensils sticking out, because when you need them, you're probably burning something and you need to grab them. So mm-hmm. instead of going through the drawer, for me, I like that. Having, just big giant sink so you can take a fish down, you can take the scale off, like we just, want somebody else to do everything for us. Fishmonger, I don't know if you ever take a fish down or you try to pluck some, you know, have somebody kill a duck, hunting duck, and try to pluck the feather. It really gave you a sense of where things come from, how the animal die, and connection to the food. And for me, if you can't do it because your sink is just all white and now looks like a slaughterhouse because everything's all white, and so, sorry.
Well, I... Next time I'm plucking a chicken in my kitchen, I'll remember that. Were there, you know, making the book about home cooking rather than about the slanted door, were there a lot of recipes that allowed you to include in the book that you wouldn't, you know, necessarily feature in the restaurants?
Well, no, we just want to pick things that are really essential for home cooking, and obviously some signature like the shaking beef at the slanted door. But also, there are some are super hard things, just, you know, like making the this bun guan, like a rice paper. You know, I assume hopefully some of my colleague and chef will buy this. It's not super easy stuff. So that for those of you that don't want to tackle it, could be a good picture story, you know, look through. But it's kind of cool to have both of these things. But most of them, you should be able to whip out in 5-10 minutes. But the noodle thing, well, first thing you got to do is go to Home Depot and buy all the hardware to make the
noodles.
Contraption, make the thing, and it just takes, you know, a couple tries. So if you do try that, make sure you have some other food in standby because.
So, well, I mean, I do have to say the book is beautiful. It was shot by Eric Wolfinger.
Yeah, it's the only guy I met. He's, you know, I get along, and he didn't, you know, count how many hours he works with me. So we went to Vietnam. I really want to bring a little Vietnam. At first, you know, people were like, "You don't only need Vietnamese picture," but I thought it would be good for you to get a sense of the place. Most people don't think of Vietnam people wearing, you know, North Face parka jacket, but. You know, I went there right around November, and I forgot, and I was freezing, you know, my tail off. And in North Vietnam, that's Vietnam. They're wearing boots and jacket, and it's cold. It's not the tropical, you know. It takes you 2 hours from Ho Chi Minh to Hanoi. It's like flying L.A. to Seattle. So you can't make Seattle or Portland guy be the same as the guy from L.A. They wear different clothes, you know.
So did you travel all over Vietnam when you were researching?
I try. But usually the food is really good in the big city. You know, Ho Chi Minh City is still my favorite. Hanoi is a little reserved. But like everything, you know, food follow money. Where there's a lot of money, there's a lot of food. Things change. You know, I've been there since first year I went back in 1992. So it was a lot less back then. But things are really happening. There are a lot of expat, a lot of young people, Vietnamese people here that move back there, and they try to create something that's really exciting. And the advent of texting and cell phone. It's funny, I was woken up by some Vietnamese guy last night at, you know, midnight because they're filming me, and he didn't figure out the time change, and he's calling me at midnight with his cell phone, into my cell phone, waking me up, try to set up a filming script. But same thing, while I was in Vietnam, I was half asleep, and somebody asked for a reservation. And I woke up, and it was 4 a.m. In Hong Kong, and I booked them that reservation, you know.
Good man. Another thing that impressed me about the book and about looking over the recipes was it seemed like there were all of these interesting, very personal tweaks to the recipes that built in a lot of flavor. For example, you talk about making the chicken stock, your chicken stock, adding in dried sea worms for extra umami, although that's not in the recipe. Or making a shallot oil mayonnaise for your spring rolls. You know, are there some other tricks that you use to add in extra flavor like that to?
Well, these are, it's not like I invented this. The Asian like to bring, when they make a stock, they don't just try to use different, like you know, pork bone or chicken bone, they like to introduce different species. Sounds kind of weird, but basically they want to bring the sea and the chicken together. They think there's something happened with those two mixing. So often they'll use a lot of dry things because, you know, like all old culture, they have to preserve things they catch they can't eat. So dry scallop, dry shrimp, dry oyster, dry mussel, dry sea worm. And sea worm was a little hard to find, but it was an area of southern Canton on the other side of the Hainan Island where my dad come from. They're known for this worm, and they're really yummy. And it was super expensive. And I think we were paying $80 a pound for this stuff. Wow. And it sound really scary, but they look like a little dry cardboard tube. And you put it in the soup, and it just adds another dimension to the soup. And this is where I try to get people to understand, like, this is where, like, in Japan, dashi, using bonito flake or using a dry scallop, just as you use sun-dried tomato, it changes. You feel like there's clothesline in your food, you know. Mm. You just like, sometimes they take bok choy and they dry it. And you make a soup from a dry bok choy, or taste, you can, like literally it tastes like your linen on the clothesline. Mm-hmm. It's got that, you know, sun-drenched flavor in there. If you discern it, it's just wonderful. And this is the kind of stuff you can have inside your cupboard, you know, when things go, you know, if you forgot to go to store, you can have all this stuff. You know, maybe go to Chinatown once a year, you know, load up all your dry goods, and it'll last you for a year. And it's great to have all those things so that you can tweak these things to make something interesting. And they don't take up a lot of room. They usually don't go bad. It's a funny story. We were testing. We want a bamboo, and we couldn't find fresh one. We were testing all these different bamboo. We bought like 15, 20, you know, frozen one from Japan, like everything acidic, acid, packaged one. The one we liked the best was something out of China that was salt cure, and it was in this little bamboo basket. It was just so primitive, but it was the best thing that didn't have the citric acid. It didn't have this frozen. I didn't have to thaw it. All I had to do is soak in water, you know, about 10 minutes and wash it. And it has the texture of this young bamboo. And a lot of that technology, you know, was great. It didn't need the plastic bag. It didn't need chemical. Hmm. And for me, like, I don't know why we're spinning around when we try to get so modern, and the Vietnamese want to be like us and we want to be like them now because we're trying to get rid of our supermarket and go to a farmer's market. They try to get out the wet market and build more supermarket. And it just completely messed up, you know? And you think of the circle of distribution of food. You know, you go to Vietnam, you see this wet market, everybody's, oh, it's gross, you know, it's wet, it's dirty. And if you close your eye, you can't smell anything because they don't have any refrigeration. There's a market right in downtown Ho Chi Minh City. No refrigeration. You get two guys that sell ice, and they put ice on fish. That's about it. Not a single refrigeration. There's a couple of electrical lines dangling, a couple of light bulbs. But you close your eye, you don't hardly see any fly. You don't see the meat. You don't smell anything because nothing to be rot because it's killed that day, cut up, eat, gone. There's no expiration date. There's no styrofoam. There's no machine that you can click it on. And that's how things should be. And we sort of just try to, you know, figure out this stuff and preserve it. When I was in Shanghai, you read the paper, these food contaminated, food poisoning, in newspaper, and some guy, you know, fake this and fake that. It's all happened in the supermarket on a bigger level. You know, if he's going to fake something, he ain't going to fake like 20 steam bun. You know, you need to, you know, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to rob somebody and do something bad, you're going to do a lot so you make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So often the people got sick. It's usually in the big department store, the big, you know, grocery store buying. They literally, in China, they have this steam bun that made out of corns yellow, and the one is wheat, the yellow one, corns more expensive. They spray painted this bloody thing. And it was in the newspaper. I mean, it's like, who on earth take their time to go get the paint, paint this thing. I mean, you got to do a lot to make any money, right? And obviously, you're not going to find that on the street food. So I was just telling you, you know, sometimes we get too... I mean, that's why the farmer's market is so amazing. A lot of these guys at the ferry bowling, they just say, all right, we don't want to go into this, you know, distribution chain. We want to change that loop. We're going to go directly to the farm, the customer. We're just going to drive for 4 hours from Fresno and come over here. Mm-hmm. And, okay, they'll charge you a little bit more for gas, but you're going to get this thing that's going to have, you know, probably, you know, 3 times more shelf life.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features chef and restaurateur Charles Fan, who's joined in conversation by Jonathan Kaufman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Do you think that more and more Asian American restaurateurs are having that sustainability conversation as well?
I don't know. I don't separate them. We all should be. Unfortunately, you know, in Asia, you would not think twice about your farmer being a bad guy, you know. So I think in time they realize this thing ain't working because the meat they buy is not very good. But also you get into this rut, you know, everything is $3.99 in Chinatown, so they're just looking at price and they can't go beyond that, and they fear that people won't buy it because it go up to $5.99, not $3.99. And educating that is very hard. Do they stop eating Chilean sea bass? You know, they don't even have time to wash the kitchen. You think they read the paper, so it's that kind of thing, you know, and sometimes it's economic, it's you know, and also it's about education. A lot of them don't have both, and that's why Chilean sea bass still serve from these Chinese banquet hall, mm-hmm. which we all know is a fish that, you know, don't make baby until they're 40 years old and they can't keep up. So, but the Chinese television, I see a lot of, you know, education in the Chinese media to talk about organic product. I mean, they know people getting cancer just like everybody else, getting sick. So mm-hmm. I think in time it will change, but it's a little slower, you know.
So what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
I'm doing turkey.
Are they wood-fired or?
I've done that. For me, the last thing I want to eat is Vietnamese food on Thanksgiving. Because, you know, it's one time a year we look forward to this tradition. Although, you know, it's funny, and in the book it was I decided to bring my, I was the oldest kid, so I decided to embrace my family, get them into this American culture. It was a shock. We just got here in 1977, we're living in Chinatown, we're living in a little Victorian flat, and the Wedgwood stove, and I don't know why, I guess I like to cook, and I bought a I was watching Jacques Pepin, and I bought a gourmet magazine. I decided to cook this whole, you know, green bean, mashed potato. It took me like 4 days to get this dinner up. and my parent, like everybody was just kind of, okay, you know, you're eating this like dinosaur chicken that is just so big, and, you know, some weird thing. And at dinner table, and they go, where's the rice, you know? And I say, no, you don't get rice with this dinner. They go, this is the American way. Oh, well, we wish we had rice because... And of course, I had some rice in the background, you know, just in case if things goes really bad. And that's the only thing. But typically, we like the tradition of having stuffing and turkey and so on. But we always have, like, one appetizer, like either... Like it could be Creole or like a boudin ball last Thanksgiving. I like to play, you know, with the turkey, and I think, you know, managing cooking a turkey is always a challenge. How do you get it coming out moist and
the word this year is spatchcocking. I don't know. Do you do that? Well, you break the back and split it apart and do it flat. And
yeah.
All the food mags are talking about.
Well, you know, we have the same problem. Like, that's why Zuni chicken takes 45 minutes because when you put a chicken in the shapes, it you know, some part's going to cook first, some part's not going to cook first. And the trick is, number one, try and stay away from the 30-pound bird. You know, the 12, 15 pounds are much easier to handle. But then again, if you have one oven, you got 30 people coming over, you're kind of stuck, right? I mean, you might need the 30-pound bird, but I think the key thing is to temper your chicken, really put it outside, you know,
bring
good 3 or 4 hours.
Room temp.
Yeah, because people just so freak out about sanitary and disease, and so they put everything in the fridge. But the more you understand about food science and food safety, fridge sometimes not your best answer. You know, if you make a stew and you make a chili and you stick it in your fridge, that's the worst place you can stick them because there's no air circulation. Your stew is too much product, so there's a incubation heat right in the middle of the stew, like your chili, and that's why, you know, in food safety, you always don't have food more than 4 inches tall. Because if you put it in a big pot like this, get it fit into your fridge nicely, you actually have a 6-inch cylinder of chili. And now that's going to get incubation. It's time and temperature in food. One other thing I'm going to try is I really try not to inject any of the Vietnamese, or I might just play with technique. Like for me, food's about stories, about tradition. So I don't really dare to stick lemongrass into my turkey because for me, it's just one time a year. That's just my personal thing. But, you know, when I work, I mean, we do a lemongrass chicken. In fact, we're testing a wood fire. It's just wonderful. I mean, we're going to cook 4 turkeys, so usually we have the simple one, but this one we might do hand-chopped lemongrass. And it's in the book. It you got to chop it really fine. It's almost like texture of sand. But when you bite into it, it doesn't grind your teeth. And lemongrass is not only for fragrance, but it's actually play on texture. Mm. And you make a rub and you tuck it under the skin, and it just got this kind of grainy, great. It's perfect for chicken marinade. And the thing, I think turkey, often people undersalt them. You got to salt them the night before and get the salt really in. And, you know, for me, food's about story, and that's why, you know, we're opening up a bourbon and fried chicken place, because I love the South, and we're paying homage to the Southern, the American whiskey tradition that, mm-hmm. you know, I've been drinking it for the last 10 years, and a lot of people from the South, I would offer them bourbon. They say, no, I only drink scotch. And it's just kind of sad to hear, here you are coming from the origin of this food, and you don't even know. And frankly, there's not a lot of them. And in fact, there's a shortage of great bourbon out there because a lot of them are no longer in business. So there's a low in terms of the great bourbon that aged 10 or 15 years. And now you just got some new guy getting into the business. You have to wait another 10 more years. And this stuff is just almost like God's will. I mean, they put the stuff in the barrel, half of them come out good and half of them don't. And they pick the good one, they call it a reserve, and the rest they just bottle it in some other brand. So
you're only going to have the good stuff. Or
well,
maybe
we
a little
try
both.
To. We try to. Yeah, there are a lot of bourbon out there. But, I'm excited. A little tiny place out in Pier 3 called Heartwater.
When's the opening date?
I had no idea.
Difficult San Francisco. So, it sounds like you enjoy opening restaurants. You've got 2 actually in the works. How does that happen?
Well, I don't know why my wife asked that question a lot. I just got sucked into fun project, and Randall Klein from SF Jazz came and said, look, you got to do this. We have a great venue. And this is SF Jazz getting their own brand new building. And I say no, I don't know how many times, but I'm glad I'm there. It's sometimes you do things because, you know, you be part of history, part of San Francisco. I live here longer than I live in Vietnam. So to be involved with them, and they seem to have a great, you know, gig and great building, and it's going to be tough because it's very small, and it's a new challenge. We're dealing with food service and catering, but you know, long as I my thing is, even if the business fail, if I make good food and the business didn't do well, so be it. I might not be a good business person, but at least I didn't. My view is I didn't compromise on my product and my mission to do things. I might not be the sharpest tools in the shed, but... And also, we have a big family. We got a lot of... I mean, we have over 600 staff members, and they need to grow. And they need to be... You know, I got to find money somewhere. You can't just have one source of income, so the multiple unit. And not just the money, but, you know, Eric Atkin, our bar manager, is heavily involved of creating the SF Jazz bar program. You know, we just got all these team members that they're not blood related, but by now I think they're kind of related.
Mm-hmm. Do you kind of move people up? I mean, do you open up a project sometimes to move people into it?
Yeah, they move themselves up. You know, they make babies, so their life changed. And like all of us, we can't stay still. You know, when I first opened Slam Door, Spring Roll was $4. I was taking home, you know, $2,000 a month. So, you know, I can't do that anymore. You know, so our chef was, I think I was paying her $18,000 a year or something crazy. But that was like, you know, we were a little hole in the wall place. But, you know, we changed and we tried to figure out. And it's just constantly balancing between customer value, paying our people, paying the farmer, hopefully there's some left. So we can buy a nice car, but it's never the case.
So do you have a fantasy restaurant project, like any sort of like fantasy football team, one that you've...
Well, right now the bourbon and fried chicken is pretty cool because I can't wait to taste the bourbon and see it all in place. you know, for the first time we're going to cook Southern cuisine. We're gonna take on, and people are going to make fun of us, I'm sure. But hey, you know, it's a small place. If we fail, I'll go to, you know, go get Donald Link from New Orleans and come and help me. I don't know. For now, I'm going to give it a shot and see if I can make it happen and make it good. A little to-go window, oyster. I don't know. We just sort of follow our passion and our heart more than our brain, actually.
Well, so far it's done well for you. I guess at this point we're going to open up the questions to the audience.
Hi, have you thought about doing ultra fine dining?
Just in my dream.
See, there is a fantasy restaurant.
No, I'm too messy to do that. I like energy, and for me, yeah. I'll be clumsy at it. I'm not sure. I personally don't even like to sit in that long of eating place. Number one, I think I just love the idea of eating family style because I hate it when I go sit down in a fancy restaurant and four of us and the chef bring four different things to all of us and now we have to like passing back and forth. It's like equivalent going to the Yosemite wall, staring four different directions and say the view is great, you know. And I think it should be about sharing, and it should be... And I love the family style. And Paul Bertolola at The Wynn, a lot of you might not know him, and, you know, very expensive restaurant at The Wynn with Steve Wynn. And he changed his menu the 2 days before opening because he had an opening night. All his family came from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, somewhere, and he had to serve them family style, and the light bulb went off. So that restaurant is a fine dining, you know, like sit-down family-style restaurant. I don't know. I never say never for anything, but for me, I love, you know, a lot of volume, feeding the masses, and for me, just nothing better than a little noodle shop, and you just wait forever to get in and slurping some noodle down.
Chef, what are some of your favorite restaurants in the Bay Area?
Oh, yeah. Is this being recorded? So my view on restaurants is a little different than yours because I'm in the restaurant. I see it all the time. So on my day off, I go places where I don't need a reservation. I don't need to see anybody or hear anybody. So places like Chutney or Lit Lot, Thai place up on Larkin Street, it's my favorite. And again, if I need a reservation, you know, I seem to have everybody's cell phone in my phone, and I can dial them and get them. And my hover to Murad's place and Aziza, or Chinatown. Like for me, it's a little different question about like all the. There's just a lot of little gem that if you kind of sequester your expectation, maybe bring your own alcohol, you can deal with these places.
I'm going to actually ask you the last question here. So who are some of your culinary idols? I know you mentioned Zuni Cafe, so Judy Rogers, and who are those chefs who you take inspiration from?
There's, I mean, in San Francisco, you know, it's exciting to see always the new generation of people doing things that I would never thought I would do, like someone doing, you know, Josh at Cezanne opening. For me, I think it's not just about food, it's about moving the dial in the customer experience. It was a little crazy, you know, to open a fine dining place in the Mission, and you have more people working for you than the customer. So, and obviously it was great, and he has to change, now he's moving. But outside the city, in Boston, you have folks that are doing Ann Sorensen, Olena?
Oleana.
North African food.
Anna Sorter.
Like, stuff like that just really, for me, it's so exciting to go and get those flavor. It's the same old story, you know, taking a tradition and just perfecting the craft. But there's always new stuff. There's so many to wonder. But I made it a hobby to look for, like there's a little Shanghai house out in Balboa, it's like 39 across the street from the theater. They got 5 table, but it just takes a little work because, you know, the menu is 100 item, but he's good only like 5, and you gotta know which one those are. And you just gotta, you know, it's not very expensive, so you might have to try it with your tongue, you know, a few times and a few misses, and you'll get, and of course, you know, save for your money for Slandor and places like that.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was chef and restaurateur Charles Fan, whose restaurants include Slanted Door, Hard Water, and Heaven's Dog. He was joined in conversation by Jonathan Kaufman, San Francisco editor of Tasting Table. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia and David Kwan. David Kwan also edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon, when Bina will feature primatologist Franz Duval. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.